Welcome to Fetch the Smelling Salts. I'm Alice Nagel.
And I'm Kimberly Marsh. And this is our podcast all about historical dramas from movies and TV shows to miniseries from every era and all around the world.
We're so happy to be sharing with you this episode in which we are talking about Persuasion.
Woo!
But which Persuasion? We're actually covering today the newest adaptation of Persuasion from the year 2022, which is on Netflix. I suppose, depending on when you're listening, it might not be the newest. If so, hello from 2022 to our listeners in 2037. And there's a new and hopefully better adaptation of Persuasion.
Oh my God, yes.
So, spoiler alert, this was not my favorite adaptation of Persuasion.
No.
But to be fair, full disclosure, Persuasion is my favorite Jane Austen novel. I'm a pretty big Jane Austen fan. Persuasion is my favorite Jane Austen novel. It's probably the one I've read the most, and like I've seen all the adaptations. And the 1995 version is probably my favorite. It's definitely my favorite Persuasion adaptation. Might be my favorite Jane Austen adaptation of all time.
Oh, really?
So, maybe, I think. So I'm a little bit biased. But you really don't have to be biased to think that this was not the best adaptation of Persuasion ever done. Which we'll talk about, but just a little bit about this adaptation. It is starring Dakota Johnson, who is who we all know from 50 Shades of Grey, the 50 Shades of Grey series, which I did not see. She was apparently also in The Social Network, which I did not see.
I saw it. I didn't know which one she was. Huh. I should look it up.
I actually don't know either.
She's also, I don't know, well, again, currently dating Chris Martin, whom I adore. Chris Martin, the lead singer of Coldplay.
Oh,
so, yeah.
I don't share your love of Coldplay. That's okay.
No! So
that made this perhaps like less painful for me to see Dakota Johnson in this adaptation, which, I mean, anything that can make this a less painful thing to watch, I was grateful for. But you, so this is your first time watching a Persuasion.
Yes, actually. So I came in fresh. So I, we'll talk about this later. So I have views about just like watching this just as a movie.
Yeah.
You know, and then later on, so after watching this adaptation, then I watched the 1995 one, right? Which you recommended. Yeah. And then I have like a lot more notes. So So I think I came from a different place.
So you had a different kind of experience of it, coming in without knowing how good an adaptation could be. And had you read the book?
No. So I hadn't read the book. I knew the storyline. I hadn't read the book. I've read other Jane Austen books, right? Mm-hmm. And I like Jane Austen.
Yeah.
So, you know, so but I was trying to kind of like come into the movie just appreciating the movie or trying to.
Yeah.
There were bits of it that I liked as a movie, but not necessarily as a Jane, well, definitely not as a Jane Austen adaptation. So yeah, so that's where I stand.
So this being the latest adaptation, you've kind of heard us mention the 1995 adaptation. There's also, I want to say, oh gosh, it's with Sally Hawkins and I don't have it in front of me now.
Is it 2007?
2007. Yes, yeah. 2007. Which is, it's good. It's not my favorite despite having period drama royalty Sally Hawkins in it. But I don't know, for me, the 1995 version is the one. There's also, I want to say, a 1970s, like maybe a 71 BBC teleplay, which is, I mean, it's fine. It's a BBC teleplay. It's really stiff. And the characters are a bit like meh. But but it's fun. It's a fun watch. But so this one was, the screenplay was done by a guy called Ron Ross and a woman, Alice Victoria Winslow. Neither of them have a lot of period drama credits between them, which I think kind of shows. And director Carrie Cracknell, who I also didn't find anything kind of like very period drama in her past. This one's been pretty well panned. It's got like a 31% in Rotten Tomatoes, although it has a 75% like viewer rating, which do better, audience.
Yeah.
It's got a 5.8 out of 10 on IMDb, which I think is pretty generous, but the reviews there are pretty abysmal. I actually noted one that just said, no, Jane would be bad.
Yeah, I've pulled out a few reviews from like, what was it, The Guardian and all of that stuff. It's like 2 stars.
Oh, of course The Guardian hated this. And that's the thing. So this was pretty universally panned, and it's kind of easy to pan in some ways if you are a purist about adaptations and if you really like historical accuracy, right? And I don't necessarily always care about historical accuracy. I mean, when you're dealing with a period drama, you want something to take you into the time. And so for that, historical accuracy is really, really wonderful. And I always love it and appreciate it. But I also, you know, I don't necessarily look for all the anachronisms. Mm-hmm. And I think, especially with something that isn't based on source material like Jane Austen, if it's kind of a newer kind of thing, I think that can be played with a little bit.
I think that's the point. But with period dramas, I mean, there's so many different kinds. Or you have stuff like, you know, like this, which is based on a novel and like a very known novel, and then you have things which are just kind of like, you know, created and just set in the time period, and then you have I guess, you know, what's happening, well, right now, right, with all this talk about the fifth season of The Crown. You know, when you have a period drama that's supposedly based on like historical facts, loosely interpreted, people who are still living. Mm-hmm. So that there's so many things to consider, you know, and then I think in each of these situations, the level of like historical accuracy and how important that has to be, you know, in terms of like the dramatization, I think it differs. It has to differ. Yeah,
it's going to be something way different when you're adapting something like a Jane Austen novel compared to like when you're doing historical fiction. Or even I really like sometimes something like is it on Amazon Prime? A show called Carnival Row, which is based on a particular period in kind of late 19th century London, but it's total fantasy. It's like fairies and all sorts of like magical creatures like that. But I would still class it as a period drama because it's set in a very particular real time and place. And so can include those historical elements and you get that kind of ambiance, even though it's total fantasy. So that being said, like we will talk about this obviously more in depth, but just in terms of some of the initial reviews that I read, some people were upset about the lack of historical accuracy, which we can go into because obviously they're just like the anachronisms are just like hitting you in the face like baseballs, and baseballs you get hit in the face with baseballs loads. I don't know. I've been hit in the face with one baseball one time,
and there you go.
And this
clearly it stuck with you.
Yeah, this felt a little bit like that, but other than that, I only found a few instances of people saying like, oh, well, it's not, they're using the whole colorblind casting, so the casting isn't historically accurate. And like, you know how I feel about that. You feel the same way, where that kind of thing just like does not bother me. I think it's cool because I like to see more non-white actors getting period drama work, because I like a lot of these actors and I like period dramas. So I like to see them in the period dramas.
And exactly. Also, and as a person of color myself, yeah. I love it because, you know, you're like, hey, look, you know, there are beautiful non-white people as well.
Yeah.
Fancy that. Yeah.
And that's the point of these period dramas is like, when it comes to something like historical accuracy, why do we want historical accuracy? Because we want to be transported. We want to have that kind of beautiful aesthetic. We want to see the manners and the mannerisms. But there's so much about that kind of period, like the dirtiness and like the way servants were treated and the way women were treated, that gets glossed over so much in the way these things are adapted, because we like that as an audience. We like to see these things romanticized so that we can map ourselves onto these characters and the universal stories that they're telling. And so, like, if you want to harp on historical accuracy, I think that's fine. If you want to really nitpick like costume and stuff like that. But if the historical accuracy and the feeling and the ambiance that you want to be transported to has to be full of white people, you should look at yourself.
Yeah.
And change.
Yes. And think about, you know, why are these stories like the ones which are foregrounded? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, why is it that these stories like are in the canon? Why are we all brought up with like Jane Austen and stuff like that, and not stories from people from like the global south, for example? Yeah. But that's a whole other podcast.
Right. Yeah. But basically this goes, this takes us to the casting, which is full of non-white actors, which is great. And just some of the non-white characters, I know you'll go into this a bit more. We'll talk about this a bit more. And you'll bring up these characters in the summary. But so we've got just a bunch of non-white characters from Lady Russell, Charles Musgrove, Mr. Musgrove, Captain Bennett, Mr. Elliot. So a lot of these very main characters, these aren't just peripheral characters. Who are non-white characters, and they're just like, it changes nothing about the story, really.
Yeah.
So right. I guess I'm trying to start right off the bat, because I know that we're going to be kind of doing a lot of criticism of this movie, just to say some things that I liked about it. And so one of those is the casting of non-white characters. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, shall we do the summary?
Yes. Okay. So please take note. This is the summary of the movie. Okay. And we're going to talk about how, you know, there's certain bits where there's some artistic license being taken in the storyline as well, where it differs from the book. Right. So summary of the movie, this particular version. Okay. So the focus is on our central character, Anne Elliot, played by Dakota Johnson, whom we are told early on had a relationship with a man called Frederick Wentworth about 8 years ago. Sadly, he had no fortune, so she was persuaded by her family.
Oh my God. I was really persuaded. Worried you weren't going to get that pun in, but you did
persuaded.
It.
Persuaded!
Sorry.
So yeah, she was persuaded by her family, namely her late mother's best friend, Lady Russell, to give him up. So at this present moment, Anne is still in love with Wentworth and regrets her earlier decision. So her family has some financial trouble because of her father, Sir Elliot's lavish spending, and they are forced to let out their country estate, Kelly Lynch Hall, and move to a quote-unquote cheaper place in Bath. I don't understand how Bath was supposedly cheaper, but okay, whatever. So they supposedly moved to a cheaper place in Bath. So Sir Elliot and Anne's sister Elizabeth, they go on ahead to Bath together with Elizabeth's new companion, a widow called Mrs. Clay, who apparently has designs on Sir Elliot. So they go on ahead with her. Anne is sent to help with the new tenants, Admiral Croft and his wife, to help them settle in before going to care for her supposedly ailing sister Mary. Okay, so because it's Jane Austen, we soon find out that Admiral Croft's wife is the sister of Wentworth, right? And Wentworth is now a rich and distinguished captain in the Navy, and that he is coming to visit in a few days. Right, so we know that. So she gets them settled in. She then goes to visit Mary, her sister, in Upper Cross, where she lives with her husband, Charles, and two kids, just across from her in-laws, the Musgroves. And this includes Charles's sisters, Henrietta and Louisa. Right. Again, because it is Austen and, you know, the world is so miraculously small, as luck would have it, Wentworth ends up visiting Upper Cross, where he meets Anne for the first time in 8 years. So it is revealed that he is, quote, in the market for a wife. And Louisa, right? So Louisa's one of her sister-in-laws. So Louisa takes a shining to him, and I guess supposedly him to her, you know, we're meant to believe. And then meanwhile, Wentworth is kind of like cold and distant to Anne. So then Wentworth suggests that they all...
Can I just add?
Yeah.
That is he cold and distant or is he stoned?
I know, that's the thing, right? That's the thing. I mean, you can't... That's why I said, like, supposedly she takes a shining to Louisa. You can't see any expression on the guy's face, right?
No.
So you have no idea, you know?
I never see an emotion.
Yeah.
Except, like, potentially being high off his ass.
Exactly. Or...
if that's an emotion.
A bit too much Botox? I don't know. Just saying. Yeah. Okay, so... Wentworth suggests that they all go to the seaside town of Lyme Regis to visit his old Navy friend, Captain Harville, right? So while there, we are introduced to a Captain Bennett, another of, you know, Wentworth's Navy pals, who was engaged to Captain Harville's sister, but sadly she died, so now he's in mourning. So then, over in Lyme, again, because it's Austen and everyone runs into each other, Anne and her little traveling party, they meet a mysterious stranger who is revealed to be the Elliot's cousin, you know, cousin loosely, called Mr. Elliot, who is the heir to Sir Elliot's estate, mm-hmm. right? Because even though he has three daughters, the daughters don't get anything, and this distant cousin is going to be the heir to Sir Elliot's estate. So we got some friction there. All right. So great. So they run into him, and just as he leaves, they find out who he is. Right. So supposedly Wentworth.
And for some reason, like Anne is vibing with him.
I know. So weird.
For no reason at all. Because exactly. He was like kind of a dick to her when he walked past her.
Yeah.
He's using like the lamest pickup. Artist. Oh. Yeah, the lamest pickup artist of all time. I think you're in my way. But we're on a beach.
Exactly. This is like massive, like bit of land, you know? You could just believe your left. No, no. No, no, I refuse. I am a man and I must stand here. So yeah.
And she was like, ooh.
Oh, I could possibly move around him. Oh. Who is this mysterious stranger dressed in black?
I haven't liked anyone for 8 years, but this guy was kind of a dick to me on a beach.
I mean, at least he's cute, though. I'm just going to say he is cute. I mean, the actor.
It's just because his eyebrows move a little bit, isn't it?
That's true. He has expressions. Okay, so right we go. All right, so Wentworth and Louisa are courting, and then this is the bit I don't understand, right? I mean, it actually happens in the book, I guess. Louisa stupidly jumps off a wall, hoping Wentworth would catch her. Obviously, he doesn't. So she goes bam, splat, suffers a concussion, and has to be like nursed in Lyme. So then went with an Anne, have to head back up across to break the news to her family. And then Anne joins her family in Bath. So Louisa's like recovering, Anne is in Bath. So over in Bath, Mr. Elliot tries to like court Anne for some reason. They have this like weird, you know, sexual tension between them. But then we're kind of like made to be suspicious of his intentions. Okay, because everything in this version has to be very obvious, like in your yeah. face. Yeah, we'll get to that later. So we're like, all right, we know you gotta be careful. This guy cannot be trusted. Right. So, but Anne is still pining over Wentworth, but she's intrigued by Elliot. And then, so this is where I think, you know, this version takes some artistic license and kind of like moving things around. She's led to believe by her sister that Wentworth and Louisa, who's now recovered, are engaged. So she's led to believe that for quite some time, right? And then Wentworth turns up in Bath because why not? And then Anne is confused, like, why the hell is he here? Isn't he engaged to Louisa? Blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, everyone is pushing, or should I say persuading.
Oh my God, you did it again.
I did it again.
How did you? Oh, manage twice in one summer.
I know, I was very proud of myself. That. Yes. So they're persuading Anne to marry Mr. Elliot. And then Mr. Elliot's a bit of a dick. He kind of like goads Wentworth into thinking that the wedding is already set. Because no one feels any need to consult Anne on this, right? So then Mary, her husband Charles, together with Captain Harville, they come to Bath. And then we learn that it's actually Captain Benwick and not Wentworth who is engaged to Louisa. Because supposedly, you know, he was there and helping to nurse her back to health and she falls in love with him, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that little storyline is taken care of. And then there's the scene where Anne talks to Captain Harville about, you know, they're debating like who is more constant in love, a man or a woman. And then she goes on about how women don't forget men that easily, even when all hope is gone. And Wentworth overhears this, writes Anne a letter confessing that he still loves her and reads this. And she runs off to look for him. And in a typical rom-com style, they unite and they kiss. And then somehow, Mr. Elliot ends up canoodling. So we see him. So she's running out and she sees Mr. Elliot canoodling with Mrs. Clay.
Didn't he tell her from the beginning that that was his angle though? He's like, I'm going to try to get with Mrs. Clay so that she doesn't get with your dad. And make a baby son.
Oh, I didn't get that. I thought he was just trying to like stop her from like trying to persuade the father to not marry her or something.
No, I think that's what's so fucked up about the whole conversation that they have where she's like, ooh, you're so hot. I think I'm into you. And he's like, that's cool. Is it all right if I also flirt with this other lady?
Right.
I don't want her to get with your dad.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyway, he gets her, right? And then they end up getting married and then everyone lives happily ever after.
Yay. Hooray.
Yeah. Hooray. So yeah, that's my summary.
Excellent. Excellent job. So let me just start by giving a little bit of background about Persuasion, the book. So I actually didn't know that this was one of the two Jane Austen novels that was published posthumously. Mm-hmm. Posthumously?
It's posthumously. But hey, what do I know? I can't pronounce anything right.
If you're American, posthumous. It's like after eating hummus. Sorry. This and Northanger Abbey were actually two completed works of hers that were published after her death. So they were published in 1818. And then, of course, she has two unfinished works. Sanditon and
yes, Sanditon.
Do you remember the name of the other one? Lady Susan.
Watsons and Sanditon.
Oh, that's right. I have that book. I got you that book in Bath, actually.
Book. Yeah.
So this was published after her death, but it was considered the last work that she actually finished. And by and large, critics kind of call this her masterpiece of the works that she was able to complete. It's like, you know, I love everything she's written pretty much, but this one is considered by kind of literary critics, which I am definitely not one of, but it's considered, you know, to be her most mature, kind of thoughtful work. It's the only work that she did that was where the main character is kind of an older, although we use that in quotes because she's like 27. Mm. But yeah, so a woman who's kind of past her first bloom, as they say. And they say that it's kind of like she, because she was like 40 when she wrote this. And so this is kind of, rather than just focusing on like young women in their late teens, early 20s, who are looking to get married. This is a different story. And it's also a different story because it doesn't just feature gentlefolk. The whole inclusion of people in the Navy is actually quite interesting because mm-hmm. of something that her dad, Sir Walter Elliot, says that like he hates about the Navy, that it takes people of obscure birth and like allows them to have a position in society that they weren't like born into. And so this is considered kind of like a radical thing at the times. It's kind of a radical thing to include in something like a Jane Austen novel. And the kind of historical background of the novel is the thing that's taking place in the background of all of this that makes the Navy and naval characters like even a possibility is the Napoleonic Wars, right?
Yeah.
So the Napoleonic Wars start in May of 1803. She meets Captain Wentworth, and in the book it's described as like a 6-month kind of period of them meeting and being in love in 1806. So mm-hmm. he's already a captain at that time, I think, if I remember right. I read like the first three chapters of the book over again, like last night.
Right.
But if I remember, like he's already in the Navy, right? He's not just planning to go into the Navy, but he's in the Navy. He's had some success. Mm-hmm. He also is not exactly a nobody. Like he comes from a genteel family. I just think that they're definitely like not at the level of the baronet that, you know, Sir Walter is. But like his sister is a gentlewoman's daughter, and his brother has a curacy, and so that's how he is like there. He's visiting his brother, who is the curate at the local town by the Elliots. So the Napoleonic Wars go from 1803 to, actually they end on today, the day of recording, the 20th of November, 1815, which is also my birthday.
Happy birthday!
I was born on the same day as the end of the Napoleonic
Wars.
Like a few years later.
Just a few.
Yeah, so the wars are ending at 1815, and then our story is taking place just around that. So if it's like she's 19 in 1806, mm-hmm. help me do basic math. She's 19. Okay. She's 19 in 1806. She's 27 now. So it's been like 8 years.
Yeah. So 1806.
Is that taking us to
what? 1814.
Yeah. So he's gone through the wars almost since the beginning. Like maybe he was in an early campaign when he joined the Navy and had some success. And then said, you know, I'm going to have my own ship and all this stuff. So maybe he wasn't a captain yet, but he was already in the Navy when they met.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I remember.
And he had some success. And then he was like, I'm going to be a big time name in the Navy. You just wait.
Yeah.
And she was like, no, I can't. So by the time he's getting back, the Napoleonic Wars are kind of like reaching their apex, but loads of sailors are coming back. They've already made their fortune. You've got this admiral who's maybe retiring, and he's taking his big sacks of money, and he's going to rent out this house. Mm. And that's how we have Captain Wentworth coming in, like making a big name for himself. Like he's got celebrity, he's got money, he's got clout, he's got kind of the the access to society now, where it's cool for him to be dining with the Musgroves. It's cool for him to be moving in the same circles in Bath as people like the Elliots. And that you get that in some of the other adaptations. That tension between kind of like the old aristocracy and this newness of the Navy being a thing that gets you into high society, and that kind of like change in social structure is there. You don't get that so much here, although that's like the least of my complaints about historical
accuracy. I mean, like aside from like the bits in the beginning where I actually wrote down the quote where like Sir Elliot says, "What good is a title if you have to earn it?" right. Yeah, so I guess like aside from that little few little comments at the start, it's all, it was like, yeah, all right, it's cool, he's here.
So just a few I'll talk about before we get into some of the kind of the big things that we want to talk about. I might just mention a few deviations from the novel. There are, it's sort of hard to just like list all of the deviations and anachronisms that are here, but some of them were really, really glaring. One that really stood out to me was when she says, do you remember when they have this conversation on the beach, right? Anne and Wentworth, in which they actually talk about where she's like, don't be mad at me. And he's like, what?
Yeah.
Who says I'm mad at you? I don't even know where I am right now. I had a joint the size of my arm. So you obviously this big, big, big deviation from the book and the other adaptations that we've seen is that like there is no subtlety. Like they don't do subtlety in this movie. Yeah. They've never heard of the concept of show, don't tell, to the point where they're even like labeling every location.
Yeah, I think, I was a little bit offended, in that I'm like, how dumb do you think your viewers are? But then again, I'm trying to think like, okay, I guess
Insult Netflix viewers.
No. I'm just thinking. I mean, I love Netflix. God, I live on my couch, right, watching Netflix. I'm thinking like, if they are kind of like looking at an audience that wants to just consume this quickly, and with like the Netflix binge culture, and you kind of just like want to consume. So that's I'm trying to be kind. And think about like, all right, why are they making things so glaringly obvious? Do you not think that people are like clearly, it's like the bit, right? You're like, okay, so Elliot is vain, right? We get it. But you have to like, it's just hilarious how obvious.
He's like walking into a room being like, I am very vain.
Yes. Like six I am going to hold a mirror in front of me and powder myself because, in case you didn't know, I'm vain.
Like she's introducing, Anne is introducing each one of her family members and these characters with these descriptions that are just so incredibly lazy. Like my sister is a narcissist. My father is very vain. My other sister, I guess, is also a narcissist. And so they don't allow for any of the tension that exists in the original story to play out, which is a really bad choice because the whole story and like the stakes in the story and the thing that draws you into the story is this tension. And the fact that they have so many feelings for each other, they have so much to say to one another, but they can't. For various reasons, they're like personal reasons because their own insecurities and their own like guilt or shame, but also just socially, the way that they're allowed or not allowed to like be in a room together to have these like private conversations, they can't express their true feelings. It takes forever and ever. It takes until the end of the movie. It's sort of the climax of the movie. And because we're clobbered so many times with all of this stuff, including them having these weird interactions, and one of which is this scene on the beach where she's like, hey, don't be mad at me, and he's like, how do you want me to feel? Which sounds like this very like weird modern conversation. And then at the end of it, she says, "We're worse than strangers. We're exes."
Oh, no, but worse than exes. Right? No, which no, is, worse than exes. We're friends, right?
That was so then later she says, "We're worse than exes, we're friends." And that's taken actually from an original quote in the book. So she's kind of, Captain Wentworth has come back into her social circle via her in-laws, like her sister's husband's family, the Musgroves. And there's nothing she can do about it. She just has to exist near him, as painful as that is. And she says, the narrator of the story says, "Now they were worse than strangers. Now they were as strangers, nay, worse than strangers, for they could never become acquainted. It was a perpetual estrangement."
Oh, that's beautiful.
And that line is so encapsulates the yearning and the longing in the story that you at least feel from Anne's side, because at that point you don't know Captain Wentworth's feelings toward her. That just the stab in the heart that she's constantly feeling, getting twisted by having to be in his presence, watch him and flirt with Louisa Musgrove, because he is flirting with her.
Yeah,
you don't really see that in this film, because
he's supposed to be, like, but yeah,
like, just, I think this is what humans look like when they smile, and I'm smiling near you, so we're in love.
And the other thing, right, with Jane Austen novels, right, you know, the beauty of it all, right, and the characterization, everything, it all comes through the dialogue, you know? Mm-hmm. And I found that in this version, in place of Austen's dialogue, you know, they put in other bits to modernize things, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, sorry, I'm probably like encroaching on something which you might want to talk about
not at all.
Later. But you know, this whole thing about, right, we have to show the modern viewer that Wentworth is a catch, right? So, you know, we're like, right, to the modern feminist viewer, Wentworth is a catch because, you know, and like, this is a bit where, like, was it Louisa says to her, "Is it true that he really listens to women?" You know, and then later on in that scene, in the beach, right, where, you know, I guess this was all created, right, where he talks about how, whenever, like, he's in a fix, he thinks about, you know, what would Anne do, and you're kind of like led to believe that, right, this guy who was, you know, is perfectly capable of like raising his status throughout, you know, in the Navy and all this stuff, and then he kind of led, like, says no, you know, throughout everything, oh, you know, whenever I'm in trouble, I really don't know what the hell to do. I just think, like, you know, what would Anne do, which is great, but they focused the dialogue in that scene was so focused on, you know, look, he's a good feminist man, you know. Mm-hmm. So, like, yay viewer, we like him because of this, and they don't allow space for all the other beautiful bits of the dialogue to happen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was
my sort of modern day kind of very superficial kind of girl.
Yeah,
what if Captain Wentworth were like a feminist?
Yeah,
and I have no problem with, you know, feminist male characters in period drama adaptations and things like that, but when it's so
heavy handed.
So obviously, ham-fistedly tacked on.
Yeah.
That too seems really insulting. Yeah. And along those same lines, all of these moments in which we're having it shoved in our face, like, Anne just isn't like the other girls. And the really super cringe moment where she is in Bath, she's having some kind of tea with her father and her sister, and the dowager.
Oh, the Viscountess Dalrymple. Yeah. Person, yeah.
Empress. and she just sits there, like, talking about how she's had a dream where an octopus is sucking her face. And then she realizes she's the octopus. It's so horrifying, not because of what she's saying. And it's supposed to be like, oh, isn't she relatable? I say really awkward things like that too. But the fact that it's the most egregious sort of like way of characterizing her without actually characterizing her. Mm. It's again taking this kind of really lazy cinematic trope of I'm just so clumsy, mm-hmm. and I say awkward things, and you know, we had two pratfalls from her also in this movie, and then she's just like, I don't know, I just drink wine from the bottle, and then I shout out my ex-boyfriend's name out the window, and then yeah. a falling gravy hits my head. Oh no, what am yeah. I like? And instead of developing Anne Elliot, who is I think one of the deepest, most like charming and fascinating characters in literature, again I might be a little bit biased, but that's sort of the point of all the Jane Austen novels, kind of like why do this to persuasion when you have a character who is meant to be more mature, kind of have more depth than any kind of ingenue that Jane Austen ever wrote. And so that those kind of things should I think infuriate any casual viewer, even if you don't know the story at mm-hmm. all, because it takes you out of that kind of magic of the period drama, because anyone can tell that's anachronistic. You don't know have to know anything about Jane Austen or historical England or anything like that to realize that that's nobody's talking about an octopus sucking their face.
Yeah, if you're watching it, that's the thing. If you're watching it as a rom-com, mm-hmm. you know, like, so it has like, it's all the rom-com tropes, right? You know, and so if you're watching it as right, you know, I got like an hour and a half on a Sunday, I'm just going to like, you know, watch myself like a nice, you know, little rom-com. And then it's like enjoyable. But for me, why it's like, it's so, I'm like, then just go make a rom-com, like make another rom-com, make a rom-com set in, you know, the 18th century or whatever. That's fine if you want to, but don't take an existing piece of work and then make that into a rom-com.
And I do want to come back to that a little bit, because I have a suggestion for the makers of this movie if they were to get a time machine, or maybe anyone else who's thinking about doing an adaptation of this movie. But just to kind of like wrap up how the story is different, the stuff that we said about Mr. Elliot, the cousin, mm-hmm. that's another example, another really glaring example of taking kind of what is a storyline that has a lot of tension. There's a lot of stuff going on beneath the surface that we don't really understand, or we're only privy to one part of the story. And then there's sort of a climax mm-hmm. and there's a reveal, just like we have, you know, the primary storyline of Anne and Wentworth and their love for each other, and there's all of this tension and all of these ups and downs and will they, won't they, and then there's this big like kind of like orgasmic mm-hmm. climax about their feelings for each other, when it's revealed, when he cottons on how much she has always loved him, and then mm-hmm. he reveals to her how much he's always loved her. But instead, in this version of the story, that basically gets revealed halfway through, when he's like, I was like you too. And she's like, okay, I'm going to go swim in the sea about it.
Oh my God, yes.
Also, this is a slight tangent, but was there a part when she is like overhearing a conversation between Captain Wentworth and like Louisa, and she's about to pee next mm-hmm. to a tree with like nothing else near it, and they're like 10 feet away?
I know, she wasn't even trying to hide.
They're literally within earshot of her, and she's like, well, I guess I'll just drop my trousers here. And she's like, oh wait, maybe I won't piss within earshot of these people, but only because they're talking about me.
Also, it looks like, I mean, it looks, yeah, like I said, there was nothing beyond that. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like everything in front of her was just a path, right? Because yeah. later on she gets up and she walks and she stumbles, right? Yeah. So why, and I'm speaking as someone who has had a fair share, you know, of peeing in nature.
Okay, good. I'm glad we have your perspective because yes. I do not pee in nature.
When you gotta go, you gotta go. I've been on the walks. You do not just sidle off on the path that you're walking and go, hey, right, there's a tree over here. Someone might walk past this path, but who gives a shit? I'm gonna go pee. You kind of want to go.
I mean, we hope. We hope yes. she's peeing.
Oh God, yes. So I can say, someone who's done that or not done that, you know, smart enough, you kind of want to go deeper into the brush.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, that the storyline of Anne and Wentworth is also mirrored by this storyline of Anne and Mr. Elliot. Because there's also something kind of going on there that doesn't meet the eye. And in the book and in like normal sane adaptations, she meets him and he is very affable, very charming. Kind mm-hmm. of the whole point of him is that he meets every kind of expectation for someone who belongs to good society. Like she says something like, he has, you know, correct opinions, good manners, mm-hmm. you know, he agrees with her on all things about like politics and poetry and philosophy. And he is a great conversationalist. He's also very engaging. But at the same time, there's something a bit off about him. And one of the things that's off is that he looks so good on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is, so did you finish watching the 1995
yeah,
version
yeah.
then?
Yeah.
So you see that what actually happens is that Anne has a friend, a school friend, because she went to school in Bath, and she meets up with this school friend to catch up, finds out that she's a widow and her husband died penniless because Mr. Elliot scammed them.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's in tons of debt and he wants to try to like get in good with the Elliots because he wants that Elliot fortune kind of in advance.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know how that works with inheritance, but he definitely wants to make sure that Mrs. Clay doesn't get in with Sir Walter Elliot and produce that heir. So yeah, you do find out, and it is a reveal that he is trying to get with Mrs. Clay.
Mm-hmm.
But again, instead, in this adaptation, he goes to her and basically says, yeah, see that Mrs. Clay over there? She's trying to hump your dad. And I don't want that to happen, obviously, because then I'll lose my inheritance and I need that money. And why you would have that conversation is so out of place. Again, you don't have to know anything about, you know, 1800s, you know, British society to know that what he's doing is really weird for like the second conversation you've ever had with a person when you're talking about like who your dad's going to get with.
Mm-hmm.
And then still saying like, by the way, you're really hot and I want to try to get with you. And this kind of, so it's really confusing. It ruins the reveal at the end because we all kind of knew that that's what it was after. It also makes no sense that she has any interest in this guy.
Exactly. That was the thing that really confused me, because it kind of like it cheapened her character a bit. You know what I mean? If the whole point was to kind of build her up, right, to be this level-headed woman who is so well-read, you know, it's so different from every other woman, and you know, they've made it very, very obvious by having all her sisters and everything be such characters, right, in and of themselves. Mm-hmm. And then you have this bit where, okay, so she finds out straight away, he tells her, right, you know, I'm here, I'm trying to stop this woman, Mrs. Clay, from marrying your dad because I want my inheritance, ha ha ha. mm-hmm. and yet she's still intrigued by him.
Yeah.
All I could think of at the time, like watching it for the first time, right, was that, right, you know, was it because, was this revelation the bit, you know, the bit that made, that intrigued her, was this revelation what started off her attraction, in the sense of like, well, at least I know what he's thinking, versus, you know, I have no idea what the hell is going on in like Wentworth's head.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, guys, you can't see this, but for the past 5 minutes, I've been kind of like dealing with my cat who keeps, one of my cats, who keeps trying to like jump up to the microphone, and I've kind of like got him now.
He's actually on your shoulders.
He's on my shoulders. Yeah. And this is the only way I can keep him away from the mic.
Okay? I love it because you use your hands to gesture, and every time you kind of go near his face, he thinks it's to pet him. So he's like, yes,
get my head in there.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like, I mean, it leaves the viewer trying to piece together what she's seeing in him, because she's like, oh, but he's a 10. Mm. She literally says he's a 10. And then the only sense that we get that she doesn't trust him is he's a 10. I don't trust a 10. Mm-hmm. Like, bitch, is that the only thing you don't trust about him? He seems like a straight up sociopath, and he's telling you he is.
Exactly.
Right away. And if we're supposed to believe that she's so still in love with Captain Wentworth that she spends like 60% of her waking hours drunk in a bathtub, mm-hmm. that she can be like, ooh, oh. But this man who was rude to me and then said really creepy ass things to me, mm-hmm. And I know is trying to get with another woman. Ooh, but he's so forthcoming. Isn't that refreshing?
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's terrifying.
Oh my God. His response to like her octopus dream, where he tries to be like, oh, well, I could be the octopus. Oh, ho, ho.
He's like, I have some anime I think you should see.
Like, ew, cringe, go away.
And that's one of the things that this adaptation kind of strips away, is that there's so much about so many period dramas and so many Jane Austen novels, and this is why Jane Austen is such a beloved author even to this day, is that there's so much that's universal about her characters' experiences, mm-hmm. that it's really easy to kind of map yourself onto it. Like, you can say, like, people have had the experience of, you know, this person looks really good on paper and everyone thinks they'd be really good for me. Mm-hmm. But I don't trust it. I know there's something not right about this situation, mm-hmm. rather than here's a sociopath I think is hot.
Yeah.
Maybe that's becoming, you know, more universal of an experience for people, unfortunately, but why make that choice for something that you're adapting, mm-hmm. from, that's supposed to take place in 1814?
I mean, exactly. There's so much rich material already there. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, you don't have to start creating like half-baked ideas, I guess.
Yeah, you're not. It seems like you're taking this incredibly well-trod and beloved and rich source material and then kind of using it to reinvent the wheel, mm-hmm. in some ways, which kind of leads me to my suggestion slash theory for the makers of this film, if they had a time machine, or anyone else who wants to do an even like crappy adaptation of Persuasion again, just set it in the modern period. Just set it in the 2020s.
That's, you know, why Clueless worked.
Do a so Clueless. Well.
Yes, like, exactly.
Who doesn't love Clueless? And it's timeless, it's silly, it's classic, it's amazing. And like, one of the reasons I think that it works is because of the source material, mm-hmm. and what they keep and then what they deviate with. But the source material is like kind of silly, like compared to something like Persuasion. Like, we are dealing, you know, there are serious things in it, but we are dealing with, mm-hmm. like two young women who are kind of finding themselves unlucky in love. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to do with that. And I think that this story, plot-wise, there's nothing that's so situated in its historical time period that you couldn't modernize it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so the Navy probably wouldn't work, but you could make Wentworth like a musician and maybe she was a musician too. And they were in a band together with his sister and his sister's boyfriend.
Okay. But what would a band be called?
Oh God. Okay. It could be like Croft and the Admirals, if Admiral Croft is the lead singer.
Yeah.
I don't know what Wentworth be. I think he's kind of a front man. Wentworth would clearly be a front man. Like maybe it started like off as
Freddie the front man. Yeah.
Yeah. Like maybe it's Admiral Croft's band, but yeah, he's Freddie the front man.
Mm.
And Anne was, they were going to like go and try to make it big. Anne was persuaded to quit the band and, you know, get a master's degree in accountancy or something. No shade to accountants.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very solid profession. I salute you. We need you. But it wasn't for Anne. She had the heart of a musician. And then they go on to make it big with Croft and the Admirals.
Mm-hmm.
And or maybe they are called the Laconia.
Ooh,
that's a niche reference.
That's a good one.
Yeah. The Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are a lot of good band names.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she stays behind. She gets a really practical job. Maybe she's like living near or with her dad and her older sister still.
And maybe she's running her father's. Oh, maybe she's her father has run their business to the ground.
She's the accountant.
Yeah. She has to kind of like find a way to keep things afloat. There we go.
Yeah. She and her mom's friend.
Yeah.
It was a family business.
And then you have like the admiral who's now like, you know, made his money. He's coming in as like an investor. Okay.
Yeah,
sorry.
So the whole thing.
Yeah.
No. This is a half-baked idea, but you can see how it kind of writes itself. Like the band gets really big, or maybe like Admiral Croft is in another band, right? Like, and Freddie Wentworth is made it big as a solo artist or something.
Yeah.
But, or he was in the band with, he knows like Captain Bennick and Captain the other guy.
Oh yeah, so he formed his own band, right?
Yeah. So like Bennick and Hargrave are in it.
Yeah, Harville, yeah.
Harville Hargrave.
Yeah.
And then he comes back, this like multi-platinum superstar.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, she's just been struggling as an accountant with her stupid father and stupid sisters. And then he comes back and now she has to watch everybody fawn over him after they said he was a nobody, and like she thinks she's gonna get with her, you know, her sister-in-law, and like all the rest of that in the story could really, I don't know how Mr. Elliot comes into it, but you know,
there could be like potential merger happening.
Oh yeah,
another business.
Look, screenwriters, we can't do your whole job for you.
Yeah. Okay? All right,
but you can have this stuff for free.
There we go.
Yeah, just if anybody is going to do one of these lame shit, like the cinematography and the costumes are Regency, but the rest of it is gonna essentially be cat barf.
Yeah.
Just either don't or set it in the modern period and then just try to like give it an ounce of creativity. And then maybe you can keep in all of that weird shit about, you know, awkwardly talking about octopus sucking.
Yeah.
And dropping gravy on your head and drinking wine in the bath.
Oh, and please do cast like, a, you know, your male lead as someone with facial expressions.
Yes, please.
Just a note.
And could somebody check in on what's his face? What is the Wentworth called? Cosmo Jarvis.
Oh, yes.
Who has apparently been in other period dramas. He was in Peaky Blinders. He was in Lady Macbeth. And he was in something, a World War II drama called My Mother and Other Strangers.
Hmm.
So he has he has some cred. He has like some PD. That's what I'm called, period dramas. He has some PD street cred. I haven't seen these other things. I can't tell you what his face is doing or not doing in them. But I think I was after seeing this, I would want someone to make sure he's okay.
I was wondering if he was trying to do, right, trying to do a Colin Firth in Pride and Prejudice, right, where he's like all serious and broody. But, you know, but there's like nuances, right? Because, okay, I'm also super biased. I absolutely love that version of Pride and Prejudice, and I adore Colin Firth in it, right?
Yeah.
So,
oh, God.
Yeah, I mean, I thought he's just amazing. Who doesn't? I know. Oh, beautiful, beautiful man. But yeah, no, but you see, but like he got the whole broodiness, but like you can kind of feel the emotions, right, behind that, right? That's what, I mean, you know, seriously, like that's how he played like Mr. Darcy so well, right? He had that veneer of like control, but you could sense, right, all the emotions behind it. I think, I mean, again, not a film critic, not, you know, in any sense, I kind of got the impression that was what, you know, Cosmo Jarvis was trying to do, but didn't necessarily come through. It could also not be his fault, because again, like there wasn't much of that, I don't know, tension and dialogue, you know, that wasn't like in your face to get that going. So
yeah, nobody really, I don't think any actor could save this.
Yeah.
I mean, even so, Sir Walter is played by Richard Grant. Incredible. And any other kind of universe in which this film was produced, Richard Grant being cast as Sir Walter Elliot, beautiful. I love it. And even he couldn't really bring anything to this. I don't think Cosmo Jarvis really stood a chance.
Poor dude.
Yeah, sorry. Can I, since we've been pooping on this film so much,
okay,
can I just say a couple things that I liked?
Yes.
Okay, one of them was actually another anachronism, but I don't know why, but it made me giggle. So one is, okay, well, first of all, this is so stupid, but she... Anne Elliot is going through like the box of like
Captain Wentworth's my god, I knew what you're gonna say.
She holds up like a ream of music
paper
and says, "This is a playlist you made."
Exactly. I wrote, look, I'm showing Alice right now. Where is my thing that I highlighted? It's like, this is my this is the playlist. It's brilliant. There you go. Well, you can't see it because my handwriting is crap, but there we go.
This is the playlist he made me. It's highlighted. Like, that made me giggle, I'm not gonna lie. And there's this other incredibly stupid exchange in which she and Mary are talking about Beethoven, and Mary says something like, "How would you dance to Beethoven?" And so she was complaining that Anne had been playing Fürerlies when they were supposed to be dancing.
Yeah.
And she's like, "Actually, Fürerlies is like really good dancing music." And Mary says, "Well, how would you dance alone? How would you dance to Beethoven?" And she says, "Alone in my room with a bottle of wine," which, first of all, how are you dancing?
Who's going to be playing? Who's going to be playing that Beethoven for you?
Okay, so that was really stupid and infuriating. But then I looked this up because I thought, I bet they even got this wrong. When was Fury
written? Good one.
And it's tricky because technically Beethoven composed it in 1810, but it was lost and not found until after he died in 1867.
Well, so you know, and just stole it from him.
And
he didn't really lose it.
That's how it got lost. Mm-hmm. She killed him.
Yeah.
And she took his music, killed him, hid it.
Yep.
Only listened to it alone in her room. And then after she died, Yeah, someone found it and they published it. There
we go. We solved it. Yep.
Yep. And Eliot killed Beethoven. So that, sorry, I'm really like, I was really scraping here, but that also made me laugh in a roundabout way. And then the last one, okay, there are two more. Yeah. One is how little anybody seems to give a shit about the fact that Louisa jumped off the wall and is unconscious.
I know.
Because that's a really big deal in 1814. If you hit your head so hard that you do not wake up for several days,
yeah,
like you're definitely probably going to die and everyone freaks out about it. And here they were just like,
you're like, oh, okay.
So I guess somebody better go tell her parents. And then they show the slowest moving carriage ever. Just like it's trotting nuts along, having this really calm conversation. Like, oh, she's so, look at her. She's all locked up in the head, I guess.
Oh,
that's annoying.
Oh, and then she obviously, you know, she recovers, all is fine. And they're like, yep.
Yeah, which also I think is really funny because it's like, I don't think it happens in this film, but in the book, I think the implication is that she kind of woke up as a blank slate.
Oh, and really?
Then Captain Benwick was able to like imprint,
fill her mind like, with Byron
poetry, and she's like, "Yes, I do love poetry, and wonderful. I love you, Captain Benwick." But the last thing was this other thing that obviously does not happen in the book or whatever. Anne is somewhere on the outskirts of Bath having a picnic with Lady Russell.
Yes, I like the death bit too. Here we go.
Yep. And Lady Russell, I forget the conversation they're having even, but Lady Russell basically
she asked Lady Russell, she's like, do you miss company?
Since her husband is dead.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she says, like, why do you think I take so many jaunts to Europe? European tours.
Wink, wink. Yes. And then at the end, like, and then like, what was it at the wedding? You see her like looking at the brochure for like the next European tour. Yeah.
She's like, I can't wait to get more European D.
Yeah.
Tour style. I'm going to tour that D because I've had French, Italian, and German, and now I need to go further east.
Mm-hmm. Got to tick those boxes off, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, so, my God.
So there were things to like about this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So is there anything else that you wanted to?
No, actually, just to say it. I mean, again, I would say that if you're coming in, personally, I feel like you're coming in, you know, blank slate, as if you'd banged your head and now woken up like Louisa. And just watching it as like just a passing time to be amused. It's all right, I guess, you know, but it could still be much better, even for like for that, even for just like level of amusement.
Mm-hmm.
But as a period drama, hell no.
No.
Yeah. So.
No. I did like some of the wallpaper as well.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to give a shout out to some wallpaper of the wallpaper colors. There's some really good teals that were chosen. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, like, you know.
Credit where credit is due. Teal again, wallpaper.
Again, as a person of color, you know, really happy that people are showing, look, hey, lots of beautiful people out there who are not white. Here we go. Yeah.
That you was she was probably my favorite Lady Russell. And I
she's cool.
That's hard to top.
Yeah.
Yeah. Casting more period dramas is a mother figure lady
who
really likes Dick.
Yep. she means, what are you gonna do? You got your husband's dead. You
got all the
monies. Exactly. You're like, this is
stone's throw away.
Yeah. You know, you got that lady to your name. You can do whatever the hell you want.
You can do whatever you want.
So why not?
So do you have any awards that you would like to give this film or anyone in it?
So I say best broody face for me. I have decided the best broody face goes to Captain Bennick.
Yeah.
So yes, he had a good broody face. It wasn't annoying. I can understand why he was broody. And so yeah. So that's my best broody face.
His face, and we don't get enough of Captain Bennick, unfortunately. We need more of him. And I think he was really well cast as someone who is supposed to be super sad, like the broodiest guy who reads the saddest poetry.
Yeah.
He looks like a hound dog who once had an amazing sausage and then they discontinued that flavor of sausage. Like doggy sausage, like a pepperoni, like pepperoni nacho cheese flavor, and he was like, "That's the best thing I've ever had." And then they discontinued it.
And you know, I actually liked him. I like this. I like the casting of him better than the actor who was casted in that role in the 1995 version.
Definitely, I could agree with that.
Yeah. So I actually thought that it was, you know, very well. I really liked him.
Yeah.
So. There we go. That's my best broody face. What about you?
Captain Bennick. I would like to award most out of place use of metallic makeup to Anne Elliot, because throughout the whole film, she has the same sort of like coppery red eyeshadow and like shimmery lip gloss, not shimmery, just like shiny, but clearly giving off a metallic sheen on her face the entire time, even in that bath.
Yeah, because you know that's what you would wear when you're out walking. I mean, when you're, you know, when you need to pee next to a tree, what else would you be wearing on your face?
Metal.
Solid gold.
I mean, that must have been so hard. I guess if your dad's a baronet, you can just grind up some copper.
I do have something I want to, and something funny I noticed in the 1995 version. Okay. Yeah. This is just off topic. So that's this bit in the 1995 version where they're all in bath and I think they're having breakfast or something. It's quite funny. And so in the center, it's a centerpiece, right, on the table, and it's full of pineapples, okay?
Yeah.
So now, for those of you who don't know, pineapples at the time it was insane. Like, people used to rent pineapples, like, for, like, the equivalent of, like, £5,000 to £8,000, right? Rent it for the evening just to kind of, like, just to show how, oh, look at me, I'm rich, I can afford a pineapple. They had multiple pineapples like in that centerpiece.
Oh my God.
And it just cracked me up. So I took a screenshot of that and I sent it to Lee, and I was like, well, no wonder they're in debt. Look at all the money they're spending on pineapples.
Their pineapple budget must have exceeded their yearly income.
Exactly.
Pineapples alone.
Yeah. So just the pineapples. So there we go.
We should post that on our Instagram.
Yeah. So I was like, no, all the pineapples. But yeah. All right. So that's my little sidebar.
Oh, brilliant. Well,
yay.
That's it. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Fetch the Smelling Salts, where we covered this 2002 adaptation of Persuasion. If you would like to suggest a period drama that you think we should watch, please get in touch with us at fetchsmellingsalts@gmail.com and on our social media on Instagram at fetchsmellingsalts. And,
all right, well, we'll see you next time.
Yeah.
For more broody faces and pineapples, maybe.
Yeah.
And metallic makeup. Goodbye.
It's all finished.